Economics is the study of human choice in the world we live. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By investigating faith in economics, we can learn how they lead to human flourishing. This is the Faith in Economics Podcast, a presentation of the Gortney Institute at Ottawa University. Welcome to our show today. I am Dr. Russ McCullough, the founder and director of the Gortney Institute here at Ottawa University and the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics. And along with me is my sidekick and partner in econ, our Gortney Institute Professor of Economic Education and Research, Dr. Peter Jacobson. We have a special guest today. So my friend, long-term friend, Chad Steenhook is with us. He comes from Ames, where I met him many moons ago. And he's always been a serial entrepreneur. And so I'm teaching entrepreneurial economics here at Ottawa this term. And I thought it'd be neat to have a guest speaker come in and talk a little bit about the real world. So that's what brought Chad here today. So he's said something to me many moons ago that always stuck with me as he was trying different entrepreneurial ventures. And he's like, Russ, there's so many ways to make money in this world. I just have to find one of them. And so it was definitely the spirit of the entrepreneur and kind of that openness to trying various things. And so his latest venture that he's been doing for a long time is to be, it's called Steenhook Environmental. And on his farm up in Iowa, he runs a composting business and mulch and some other things with yard waste. So kind of some multi-products and services going on with that. And then he also helped to start back a number of years ago, Goats on the Go. And so essentially hire them and they'll fence some goats in on your acreage and the goats will knock down about everything in sight. And so you can pay some money to have a goat mower, essentially. So Chad, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So give us a little bit more background on your start and some of these businesses. I gave a little thumbnail sketch there, but some other insights for us on what you've done.
I think what happens when you're a kid and you grow up on a farm and you just see all these different ways your family's making money, it's just really interesting. It's how many gallons of milk does this cow produce? And how many gallons of milk are you selling and how much butter are you going to get out of that? And how many acres of corn do you have and what are you getting per acre and what's the price per bushel? And I think that has a lot of the entrepreneur spirit in it, is that you're always around things that individual things and basically their own little businesses that are making money, whether this year we decide to buy pigs and this year we're doing some cows and this year we're doing more milk and baling hay. And so I think when I was a kid, I think being good with numbers, it just caused me to do the math on that stuff a lot. And I think that's what made me interested in it. And my very first job as a kid was raising puppies, you know, and got the taste for putting in the effort and earning a little money. And then from then on, I just kept looking for opportunities for things that I could do on my own. When you're on the farm, everything is farm related and goes back to the farm. But if you can find something that was is your own, then you could keep that money and keep a little something for yourself. So raised some puppies. And one time I rode my bike to the store to buy people candy and they would pay me a little fee. And so just from that point on, just earning money from something that I had come up with was interesting. And it just grew from there.
So what tips would you give? I like what you said to my class earlier. If somebody's thinking about starting their business or they just kind of know that they want to do something and be entrepreneurial, what's some words of wisdom from somebody who has done a lot of starts and stops and
again? So one of the things that you have to do is you have to start right now, start fast. And you also have to start lean. You need to not be so heavily involved that if it doesn't kick off that you're not ready to quit and go do the next thing. And so one of the things I like to say is, you know, big companies will have, you know, they'll run a test campaign, they'll run a test market on something. Well, when you're an entrepreneur and you're just getting started, that is what you're doing. You're running a test market. I have idea A will work. Well, you need to find out right now, and you need to find out for as cheap as you can and for time and for money, so that if it doesn't kick off and you were wrong, you can go try the next thing. And when it kicks off, you'll know. It won't be a surprise and it won't be hard to get there. It'll just kick off.
Tell us a little bit of how that worked with Goats on the Go.
Well, so my friend Aaron calls me, and he's the one who gave me the name, the serial entrepreneur. And he says, oh, he thought to himself, Chad will be for this. And so he calls and says, hey, I'm going to buy some goats and I'm going to use them for eating weeds and brush. Do you want to do that? And I asked him one question, and the question was, does it work? He says, yeah, it works. I said, all right, let's do it. And so, you know, I already live on a farm. I was out 12 goats, the cost of 12 goats, but I could always sell those goats. And then that very next spring, we started. And we did a little test project so he could prove to me that it worked. And we just donated it to our local park. And then they ate everything. And then I said, okay, that's pretty compelling. Let's do it one more time. And then they ate everything again. I was like, holy moly, these goats are amazing. This is unbelievable what these goats will do. And we issued a press release and everybody loved it. And it just kicked off. The phone hasn't stopped ringing since that day. That was 11 years ago. And, you know, that's how I knew that that's how it should go in business. You have an idea. This could work. I don't know if people will pay me for it, but let's find out for as fast and as cheap as I can. And then you'll know. And Goats on the Go from that moment just kept growing and growing and growing. So.
And then where is it today in terms of how you've grown it? So you had a lot of business, 11 years ringing off the hook, but it's expanded, right?
Yeah. So because of its success, and as far as it, so much that everybody wanted to know either, hey, how to do it, or can they hire us? It got outside of our range of service very quickly. You know, you can't drive goats hundreds and hundreds of miles to help people. So we were getting calls from all over the nation on, hey, I want to do this. How do you do this? Or, hey, I want to call you. And we were like, well, I hate to not serve these people. This is a great idea. So over the course of the few years, driving to jobs, talking with my partner, Aaron, we just kind of came along the idea that we would do an affiliate program. And affiliate program is kind of like, if you've heard of CrossFit, they're just licensed to use that brand. They get trained in the way of CrossFit, and then they're licensed to use the brand CrossFit. So you might have whatever your town name is, CrossFit. And that just means they're paying a fee every year. And that's the way we decided to go with Goats on the Go. Goats on the Go is a brand name. It's trademarked. Our logos are trademarked. And then we license the use of that. But to receive that license, you must receive training from Goats on the Go on how to do targeted grazing. And so there's, you know, part of the training in there and then the how to. And that just works really good for helping out small family businesses and small family farms. You know, goat grazing for 150 days, we call it, is our season. Isn't going to provide enough money for, you know, to replace a whole person's income, but it's going to provide you a good amount of money. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the way we decided to go was just help small family farms earn a little bit more money, you know, from something they might already be doing.
And less management for you in terms of expanding or franchising. Basically, you turn the license over to these people and they have a lot of freedom on how they run their Goats on the Go, or is it a lot of restrictions on doing it this way, according to company policy? You know, and what have you ran into challenges where people are going too far outside of what you would want them to go or not?
We've got about 60 affiliates right now, and everybody started not knowing how to do this business. And so they're very conscientious of this is how you should operate. Now, people do things differently than we would do them, and that's okay. And under a license agreement, it's their business and they're using our brand. And if we don't like how they run their business, we don't have to allow them to use the brand anymore. But in general, they get to run their business how they want. They get to decide what goats to use, how many goats to use, what type of fencing, how much to charge. All that stuff is up to them and non-regulated by us. And that's the difference between a franchise and an affiliate situation where we have them paying for the use of our brand.
Is it a year-to-year contract?
It is a year-to-year contract. You start with a two-year contract and then you can go up to five after that if you like. But it's just an initial 2 years.
Does the owner have some protection, I guess, for lack of a better word, that as long as they don't step too far out of bounds, they kind of have the right to, as this is an ongoing concern, because they've invested a lot of time, money, resources. If they've been doing it for 4 years, I'm just wondering, do they have any like concerns, or is there anything contractually that says, I feel comfortable, I could do this for the rest of my life, right?
Right.
I love this goat business.
I think we would set it up. I should mention that this part of the business I sold off to my business partner originally.
Right.
And I think we've talked about it in the past, but you know, 5 years of pretty long. Things change a lot. So, but one of the concerns you're talking about as far as, hey, I don't want you to put a Goats in a Go affiliate right next to me. Mm-hmm. And that's why we assign territories. Mm-hmm. And so we allow you to operate inside this certain area. area as a goat grazer under that brand. So only one person in an area can use our brand in that area.
Yeah, so it makes me think about in the entrepreneurship literature, one of the big names is Israel Kirzner. And he came up with this idea of entrepreneurial alertness. It's kind of the coin that he termed that really what an entrepreneur does is they see opportunities to make resources more valuable than they are, is maybe a good way to put it. You know, you see a place where, oh, if I just move things around, it'll become more valuable. And so I'm thinking like idle goats being moved into, you know, not idle goats here. But I'm curious, like, how you and your partner spotted that gap in the market of, you know, what is the real separation between like goats or like just hiring out like a mower or something like that? What's the real advantage there of the goat method?
So the goat method has a couple advantages. And one is that you're not using any fossil fuels to get rid of your problem. You're also improving your soil by having hooves on it and waste products, you know, manure on your land. And then you're also still eliminating the invasive species. One of the things that helps a lot is that when you see a, you know, a full woods, you have this nice timber and this property that you bought, and it's just full of underbrush and it seems overwhelming. But once the goats get in there, you realize that it might be 6 to 10 plants. If you just cut those off and treated those with chemicals, then you would be a lot better. And you'll get to do that without risk of poison ivy and other things because the goats have gone in there and cleared it out. So it takes the dauntingness and the whacking through the brush out of the equation for the homeowner. And that's a big benefit. But one of the other benefits is that it's a lot of fun to have goats on your property for 5 to 10 days and have them eat eat the stuff on your property. And then you can go in and tackle the project as you need. And
I wondered about that. How much of the business is like people with kids who are like, oh yeah, it'd be cool to have the goats around and the kids play around and all that. So.
Yeah, a lot of it is that you can't underestimate the pleasure that people derive from having the goats there.
Yeah.
A, that, you know, they get to watch them because goats are ridiculous most days. And B, you know, they can talk to their neighbors, and it's a reason for neighborhoods to come together and see what's going on and talk to your neighbors. And that has a lot of appeal. And so, yeah, they do get a job done, but you can't underestimate the pleasure that's, you know, derived from that as well. So
were there any unforeseen like issues that you experienced? So like my thoughts, I'm thinking specifically related to the business model, like, you know, are goats like impervious to all kinds of like plants, or like, can they get, you know, hurt? Did you ever had any experience with that? Or like another sort of like, you know, small issues like goats escaping or things like that. Did you ever have any early challenges like that that were unanticipated?
One of the early things was the people respecting the fence.
Okay.
I was surprised with people's willingness to touch electric fence.
Okay. Wow.
Mess around with the fence.
Yeah.
And you set up the fence so like yourselves as part of it. Like,
yeah.
Goats on the go will go come out and they'll fence the area themselves.
Yeah. Right? And this fencing is fairly new product, which makes this job possible.
Yeah.
It's maybe 20 years old and it's electric net. And so it looks like a net of fence.
Okay.
And it's all electrified except for the very bottom one. And, you know, you put up signs and I was still amazed at how many people, even when I was standing there, would just touch the fence. So you have that problem. The other one was I didn't anticipate people touching it, but also dogs on leashes would be allowed to touch it.
Like, okay.
You know, so
yeah,
I didn't understand, you know, and I'm a little biased. I live in Iowa. I assume everybody understands that this will hurt. The electric fit, the non obeying of the electric fence was kind of an interesting one.
Wow.
How did you respond to that? Did you put up extra signage or something? Or
We just let go. I mean, they touch it once.
Yeah, that's what they learn. Yeah.
So it's a pretty self, you know, we've solved a lot of problems with it right away. But
yeah,
as far as goats and what they can eat, they can. So people say goats will eat anything, and that's not exactly true. They will taste everything.
Okay.
And there's only a couple things that even if they taste it will kill them. And those are more ornamental around directly up against house stuff. That's not in the woods stuff.
Sure.
There's certain times of years they'll eat certain things. And I didn't understand that at the beginning. And so you have to be able to manage expectations if they have a certain plant in there.
Okay.
You just need to tell them the goats are not going to eat that until they're starving.
Yeah.
And then it might hurt them. So we will move them. So, yeah.
What was the rate of production of them mowing down something again that you gave in class? Based?
So 240 goats will eat an acre in a day.
Acre a day.
Wow.
And 30 or 40 goats will do about 3 to 5 days, just depending on the density.
Yeah.
240 will eat pretty much any acre in a day.
And they just get up when you say 6 feet and lower, they just get on their hind end.
Yeah. They just climb. Climb on on whatever they can climb on, hang on whatever they can hang on. They'll push down branches for their friends to eat it. They'll walk with the tree branches between their legs to push it down on the little trees. And then they'll strip the bark off of most trees. If you can scar the bark with your thumbnail, it's soft enough for the goats to eat it. And they'll eat it.
All right. Well, this looks like a good spot for a break. When we come back, we want to quiz chat a little bit on some other pressures and government involvement in his various businesses, whatever one comes to mind, some of the challenges that he's faced. And I also want to pick up on this alertness thing. And that's how I perceived it. I want to see how Chad thought he's been alert over time to different opportunities and how he processes that as an entrepreneur. We'll be back in just a bit.
Ottawa University has an exciting new major, PPE, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Each of these fields is interesting in their own right, but they intersect in ways that are important to understand, both individually and for your community. If you find philosophy fascinating but want to make sure that your study of the subject is practical, if you enjoy economic analysis but want to see how economic laws interact with moral principles, if you are interested in politics but want to explore how economic and ethical realities constrain our political choices, you should consider the PPE program at Ottawa University.
This spring, Ottawa University is organizing a PPE League competition for politics, philosophy, and economics. Students in this competition will compete leveraging the ideas of philosophy, politics, and economics in various events. If you're a professor or an advisor of college students and you're interested in your school competing in PPE League this spring, contact Peter, Justin, or Russ today.
By 2030, the Gwartney Institute will be known for its alumni, supporters, and participants who incorporate economic understanding with their faith in their careers, vocations, communities, and personal lives. We have some great programming going on for high school students. We have an online microeconomics class. Yes, you can earn college credit for $200 by taking an online class. It's affordable, flexible, layered with support. Our new online micro is optimized for you. If you'd like to consider some events for your high school students or that class, please contact Justin, Peter, or Russ today.
All right, so we're back, and Peter brought up the alertness concept of that the entrepreneurs are just kind of alert to thing. And the thing that's funny about alertness is it's not quantifiable. Like we can't employ a certain number of units of entrepreneurship or something. And so that's where it gets really hard for economists and why entrepreneurs have been kind of the black box for economists. We want to quantify things and measure it. And so, every economist would probably say, oh yeah, entrepreneurs are important part of the economy. And then they kind of get ignored because there's nothing really to easily observe and see. And part of this was through Israel Kirzner's comments on just its alertness, and it's just there. And so when you get that aha moment, it's more of just, it's there and it's obvious to the entrepreneur. And then Chad's advice is to run with it quickly and at low cost to see if your aha moment is really something that's marketable or not, or if it's just something maybe of a cool novelty or something. And so, Chad, I just want you to comment on how you feel like you've been alert, or how your alertness manifests itself maybe in your life.
Well, I was talking to your class earlier today, and I kind of refer to it as a worldview. You just have to view the world in a different way as an entrepreneur. And some of that happened in my childhood. It just kind of set me up to see things in a different way. So, my daughter goes to the local orchard, and I said, how much did you spend? And she says, oh, I spent $50. I said, you spent $50 there? She's like, yeah. And I said, well, how many people were even there? Oh, there had to be 1,000 there, Dad. And I was like, good grief, 1,000 people for half of a day on a Saturday. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the alertness. And when you talk about alertness, it seems like I'm always running a calculation in my head of if this, how much of that. And so you see something going on in the market and you're like, geez, I wish I had more of that, or I wish I had less of that, or what can I do to change this situation? And then I run the numbers quick. I said, well, if this, then this, and that's not enough money. It's not worth my time to try that, And so I think the alertness is just this nature that you can nurture, in the fact that you're always trying to run the numbers. Do it in your head. Does it seem to make sense? And you just have to kind of see those opportunities. I was doing a mission trip in Haiti, and the guy I was with used to sell hostas once a year. And I was like, okay, well, how much work and how much time did you spend? And then at the end, I said, how much did you make? And he tells me, and I'm like, good grief, that's a good return on your money. I think I'll do that, you know? And so,
Now there's the annual hostess.
And now I have an annual hostess sale
from the Haiti trip.
Yeah. So it's just that alertness to what people are telling you, pay closer attention. You know, I could have been mad at my daughter for spending $50 at a, you know, basically a glorified amusement park that's like our own farm we live at. But instead, I thought, oh, my goodness, $50. Right. Something caused her to spend that money.
Maybe I could do some hay rides on a Saturday.
That's right.
Whatever. Yeah.
You know.
Well, and I think asking that question, which for a lot of people is uncomfortable, like when your final question to the guy in Haiti was, well, how much money did you make on that thing? And then it's like, whoa. Otherwise, that conversation could have ended, right? Oh, yeah, well, I got kind of busy and some people other volunteers lost interest. And so I don't do the hostess sale anymore.
Right.
But your close of that is, you know, being opportunistic and just aware that it used to be kind of a big thing. And
yeah, and people don't get offended. They know who you are and they know you're curious about those things.
Yeah, people long ago gave up on Russ McCullough because I ask questions all the time.
And so it's just one of those things that you have to find out what's going on in the world, and you need to pay attention to what people are doing. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in equipments, and one time I just got really curious on why people were buying Priuses. I didn't understand it, you know? Yeah. And so I did a lot of research on why people bought Priuses, and, you know, that's just one of those things. You gotta be searching, and you gotta be figuring out, and you gotta be learning the market, and you gotta understand people's behavior. That's why when, you know, we lived a lot closer together and, you know, we played softball with all those economists. That's why I was always so interested. Like, I didn't forget the things that you guys would sit around talking about, and I had no input.
Here we didn't know you were a sponge.
I was just soaking it all up.
At the softball field.
Because I wanted to know about human behavior, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that gets us into something Russ mentioned earlier, you know, learning how things work. I think one of the things that you can't really explain to people very well until they experience it is like what it is to deal with regulation and government involvement in business. You know, you hear this word if you're not an entrepreneur, if you're not involved in creating business, of regulation all the time. But the everyday person doesn't experience much regulation. Like to most people, regulation is, oh, I go and wait at the DMV. But if you're like a W-2 employee at a business, which most people are, the regulation is basically handled for you. I mean, you got some paperwork to fill out. Maybe you have a HR system that you have to check some boxes. But can you talk to a little bit what the world of regulation looks like when you're an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So one of the things that you have to understand is that when you're doing a business, everything that is related to that is run through management of some level of government. Hmm. And that is a regulation. I own a composting facility. And my composting facility is not allowed to take certain things because of regulations. Hmm. Now, those regulations are really odd and not specific in solving some problem they perceive could happen.
Okay.
And so one of the things is that I would have to make my area that I compost on impervious, okay, so that it doesn't go into the groundwater. Hmm. But there's no regulation for it to just run off my property. So I have to spend $500,000 to make the ground impervious, but there's no rule for me to just let it run off my property. Right. And so there's all sorts of regulations that are out there that cause you to maneuver through or just take head on. And so a lot of times the entrepreneur needs to maneuver around it at the beginning because they're just so cumbersome. And the thing is that when I read the regulation, I thought, oh, they don't want water from composting to go into the streams. Well, I can do that. You know, I'm a good neighbor. I don't want it to, you know. And so I built a system on my farm so water does not leave my property. It stays on my farm until it, you know, soaks back in through the mediums that I've set up. And so I solve the problem without doing their solution. And I think a lot of times what people don't understand is that regulations are a pre-tax on something you haven't done. Mm-hmm. You know, you may never have polluted the groundwater a day in your life, but they're going to tax you as if you had.
Sure.
And then the worst part is if I did pollute the groundwater, there's no penalty for me then, even because I followed the regulation. Sure. You know, that gives me some sort of fake protection to not pollute the groundwater. Well, it's kind of backwards of how it should be. You should penalize me if I pollute the groundwater. Why do you care how I do it? And so that's one of the things that people don't understand about regulations. These regulations are meant for a good reason, when you could just assign penalties for these things and, you know, punishment for actual action instead of pre-punishment for never have done it. And so it just ends up being a tax.
Yeah. Would you say there's also like generic regulations that are like every business, and so like business licenses I could think of, or like, you know, if you want to make a corporation, having to go through like articles of incorporation and pay the fee depending on the state, and some people incorporate in different states to save money and all this stuff. Have you gotten pretty good at that sort of thing? Like, do you basically have it down of like, all right, these are the first five steps, I'll take care of all those things? Because I feel like that's a huge barrier to some people, is they would start if they just knew how to start. Like the question is, some people just don't even know what they don't know. Right?
Yeah. And when you're at some place where you're at the very beginning, you don't even know the first question to ask.
Right.
I don't even know what I don't know yet. You know, where do I start? And so I think that, yeah, that it is a barrier. That's an understandable barrier in the fact that we need to know what business you're doing. So if you cause harm or you do something, sure, we need to know your information. But yeah, it's a barrier for sure to entry. And it's not a hard barrier to overcome once you learn the paperwork. Mm. Once you have $200, you just hire an attorney, and next thing you know, you're a business.
Okay.
You know, so it's not a too hard of a thing. And and once you actually earn money, you can talk to an accountant and have them tell you, oh, you should be this type of business. And then you just tell your attorney. And so you just hire that part out, that you know, the paperwork side, just find a good attorney and they'll get you through.
That's good. It's good to hear that. One of the main studies that was done a long time ago, I think basically 2000 was around the time, was Hernando de Soto's, I believe the book was Mystery of Capital, but his question, de Soto's question, in the book I'm referring to, if it is Mystery of Capital, I hope it is, was, why is it that like all there's like all these like South American countries that like nominally have like very similar laws to us, especially around like business creation, but in reality, like their rate of entrepreneurship is so much lower, and it seems like people aren't as engaged in business there. Mm-hmm. And what de Soto kind of blows the lid off of, and everybody kind of knew to some extent already, but they didn't know how bad it was, is the issue in places like, you know, Peru is one of the countries I think that he looked at. It's not that people don't have businesses there, it's that they can't really make formal businesses, because unlike here where it is just like, you know, $200 or waiting on, you know, the license for a couple of days. I can't remember the exact numbers. I think it was like 80 something days was the average in some countries to like get an answer on a business license. And like, that's including like, you know, people asking for bribes and things like that. Right. So, you know, you can have the same laws on the books, but the real question is like, what is the cost of doing business? What is the cost of starting the business? And it's good to hear that we're not at a point yet where people are like, oh yeah, it's so hard to get the business license and all that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think as somebody who's started up many limited liability companies, and when I came to Kansas, I did the same. I kind of knew what I was doing, but I literally officially opened up a Kansas business in about 45 minutes.
Okay.
And there's some paperwork that I knew the type of paperwork it was from my experiences in Iowa, but I thought that was pretty good, that I, you know, a person starting out. And again, if you didn't know what I knew, maybe it would take you a couple hours or something. But I was able to get official sanction from the Secretary of State in Kansas, and you're off and running.
Yeah. And you just had to wait for it in the mail, right? For your.
Yeah.
Your
well, filing. You could start operating though.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was the same. You know, I did my first one on my own and it took me a couple hours, but that was my first one ever on my own. I didn't even know what I was doing. So
yeah,
I just decided I wasn't going to mess with it and hired the guy last time. So
yeah, the harder thing I think is this stuff like occupational licensing. So somebody says, I want to go cut hair for a living. Well,
yeah,
2000 hours of cosmetology school and a $20,000 tuition bill, and then you can cut your first locks of hair or braid right, or whatever. And so
right,
I'm thinking you haven't ran into as much of that. I also couldn't help but think regulations kind of helped your business in a sense, that in Ames you couldn't burn your yard waste, right?
Correct.
And you couldn't dispose of it maybe in other ways. So you had to use a yard waste disposal site.
Right.
Enter Chad Steinhook, and all of a sudden that's a gap. That's a business opportunity.
And that's the awareness we were talking about before, because I was having to dispose of yard waste. And
Tell that part of the story. Yeah, I forgot about your other business prior.
Yeah, so I had a tree service, and I was having to pay massive amounts of money to my friend Bill, who was taking yard waste. And I said, Bill, this is crazy. He goes, yeah, man, this is nuts. It's the best. And I said, yeah, I bet it is. And he says, you know what? My deal here is up in 5 years. You need to open a yard waste site within the next 5 years because I have to close. I said, oh, all right. And I said, then they got into the awareness. What are you doing? What's the deal? And he told me the situation. And, you know, I did the math. I didn't want to ask him how much money he was making, but, you know, I did the math on what I was paying.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's just that awareness. And so, yeah, the regulation did cause my business to exist.
And I guess explain that. That's an interesting detail. I totally forgot. The city of Ames awarded a yard waste site, right?
There was
a bidding process. Explain a little bit about
that. So the overall rule is from the federal government, and we're not allowed to burn yard waste, leaves, and wood if you accept it from another location. So I accept yard waste from another location, so I'm not allowed to burn it. So landfills aren't allowed to burn it. You're not allowed to burn it. That was a federal rule. Then the city of Ames passed a rule. Well, we don't want people burning leaves in the gutters anymore, and, you know, things like that. And so they pass a rule that they don't allow their citizens to burn at their house in a burn barrel or whatever. For safety, you know, people living close together. Well, in response to that, they had to provide a way for people to dispose of that. And so they get some money from the federal government, and then they subsidize some of it.
They would pay you a free yard waste day.
Yeah. Right? And then I had to allow residents to dump for free five times a year, a couple times in the spring and three times in the fall. And those are free yard waste days.
Do you still have that contract today?
I never was awarded that contract.
That's what I was thinking. You never did.
No, okay. I always bid too much.
So there is a,
but there is a site.
That question. There's another site or a couple different sites, but only one of those sites gets designated from the
city.
Essentially, the city's a customer, right? And then you allow those five free yard
waste days. And so I opened my yard waste site because of my Bill's friend's recommendation. Then I bid on the contract and it was way too low. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the other person's doing for money in their life, but the contract was way too low. And so I didn't get it, but I just changed how I operate. I'm on the honor system. I'm up, open from sunup to sundown every day, and it's way more convenient for everybody. So every day that it's not a free day, I get the rest of the yard waste and I don't have to take it for free.
Yeah. And how do you think the honor systems work? Do you got cameras set up?
Yeah, we've got cameras. Okay. That's just for people's safety.
Sure. Of course.
I don't want somebody to,
But in general, you think pretty good?
I would say.
Wins? How many cheaters do you think? What's your
I would say. I would say that 5% of people have no intention of paying me when they come out. Okay. And I would say about 15% plan on paying me less than I asked.
Okay.
But everybody else is pretty good. And it's kind of this funny thing because so many people like the honor system and they're so thankful that it's there. They kind of police each other while they're there together. Mm-hmm. Cause I've heard of, hey, you have to pay up there. Like they tell each other, don't forget to pay, you know? So I think there's a certain amount of people that are defending us in the way of like, this is great. Don't wreck this system.
Yeah.
You know?
Huh.
So
yeah, a little social pressure system, which has worked in developing countries also to various degrees. But I think overall, where you loan money to a group of people, and then basically there's pressure for each person to pay back their microloan, because the others won't get a microloan if you don't pay back.
I got you.
And so they have this intentional setup of social pressure, because the banker really can't monitor and bird dog, a non-payer. So they have that friend network or that business network do it. And that just kind of reminded me of that a little bit with your thing, although they can come in the dark of the night, make sure there's no cars around if you're one of the cheaters.
Then we just sick the dogs out. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, it's a good system. There would have to be a lot of theft and problems for me to hire someone for all that.
Well, and then ultimately you take their yard waste and make money on it.
Well, there's that too. I make
by
it
turning it into compost. Obviously there's a process there, production process. But so maybe to start wrapping up here, I liked what you said to the group earlier, my students, about having yourself a goal ahead of time. And you had, what was kind of your goal with wanting to pursue this? What was some of your objectives, you know, as it relates to your family?
So I grew up on a farm and I really loved that life. And I wanted a shot at giving my kids that life. And so living out in the country on a farm was my first goal. And then if my wife wanted to not work in town or whatever, then provide enough money for that. But what I was telling the class is that you need to know where you want to end up before you start. And you can start a lot of different businesses. And as long as they feed in knowledge or experience or something where you want to go, then that's a great business for you to do. And don't have any preconceived notions of the road you'll have to take to get there. Just take the road that's in front of you. And if it helps you get there, then do it. And if it doesn't, then don't. And, you know, don't start a baseball memorabilia club when you really want to, you know, do sports management in Chicago. You know, this doesn't help you get there, you know. But I've done a lot of different things. I've cut trees down for a living so that I could hopefully live on a farm. And I've taken yard waste on my beautiful farm so that I could live on a farm, and I make compost out of that yard waste to help me stay on the farm. And I raise goats and cows and different things to help me stay on the farm. And it's just all these things that, that are not traditional farm things, but I get to live on a farm. And yeah. So,
and early on, you might have started to abandon the tennis racket stringing business, yeah. Right? That was one of the first businesses he did. Was
I had like a little pro shop.
Local racket club had a pro shop.
Yeah.
And that'd be an example of not very moving you towards.
Yeah. Yeah. Moment. Just in that moment, it helped just learning how to run a business. But yeah, right. I mean, it was never a permanent thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to tell the kids, is that you just have to get started fast, abandon it if it doesn't work, and try again. And don't care about the road that it takes you to get there. Don't be, you know, judging, I have to do it this way, or I have to be here this fast. Have bigger goals than money and things like that. Have, how much time do you want to spend with your family? How much time do you want to have to yourself? I don't want to work in Iowa in the winter, right?
Yeah.
So I farm, right? And so that's one of the things, one of my goals. And so I avoid anything that, you know, any job or any opportunity, I just avoid it. I don't want to do that in the winter, so.
All right. Well, that sounds like some good words to close on. So, Chad, thanks for joining the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for expressing your views and insights on entrepreneurship, not only to our audience listening, but to students here at Ottawa as well. So this has been a production of the Gortney Institute here at Ottawa University, and I'd like to thank you all for listening. A 5-star rating helps other people find us. Otherwise, be sure to pass this along to your friends and family via whatever devices and social media you choose. Other than that, be fruitful and multiply. Thanks.